today on a very special episode of the Enneagram Journey.
Give me your hands, show me the door. I cannot stand to wait anymore. Somebody said, be what you be. We could be old and cold and dead on the sea. But I love you more than words can say.
Touchstone Pictures presents The Second Coming of Sister
Allison McCrary.
She's back in the habit again. This time, she's giving a group of holy terrors a lesson they'll never forget.
So my family never saw him again, well, except for on the wanted posters.
Look, I'm really sorry. When I saw it on the computer, it said the Butcher of Cadiz. You know, but I thought it was a profession, not a headline.
It's just one of those horrible family legacies we've all tried to forget. But thank you.
Look at that. I guess sometimes I call men beautiful too. I guess I'm open-minded as hell. I think you're pretty good-looking.
That John Ralphio is something special. And so is today's episode of the Enneagram Journey podcast with Suzanne Stabile. My name is Joel, and today's conversation is the second half of our sit-down with Enneagram 3, Allison McCrary. This episode is incredibly great, too, because the Reverend kind of takes the reins or takes over the host chair, if you will, and lets Suzanne and me come along as he and Allison talk about their journey over the years. If you like today's episode, you may want to consider applying for one of the 2025 LTM cohorts. Next year, LTM will host an unprecedented 6 cohorts. The flagship program, the Enneagram cohort with the Enneagram Godmother, the Deconstruction and Reconstruction cohort with the Reverend Joseph and Suzanne Stabile, the Enneagram and Contemplative Spirituality with Joe and Hunter Mobley, aka Enneagram Hunter, the Enneagram and Family Systems cohort with Dr. Andy Stoker and Suzanne Stabile, the Leading Change cohort with the good Dr. Andy Stoker, and the first ever Enneagram for the Modern World cohort with Joey and Billy Shuey, who you may know online as the Enneagram Parents. These groups are going to meet once each quarter for 3 days in Dallas. Visit lifeinthetrinityministry.com or click on the link in the show notes for all of the good info you need, including the dates, the expectations, and the applications for the 2025 LTM cohort program. The deadline to apply is August 20th of this year. What else is in August? Great question. You know, it is the 2024 Enneagram Bootcamp, Stress, Loss, and Relationships with LTM and Suzanne Stabile. May is the final month to take advantage of the early bird price to join us in Dallas or join online from wherever you are. Replay of the 3 days teaching, August 1st through the 3rd, will be available for all participants. A topic in today's podcast is community. Enneagram Bootcamp and the cohort program are two fantastic opportunities to find and engage in community, and we hope you'll consider them. But now, let's pick up where we left off with Allison, Suzanne, and the Rev.
So many questions, both at LTM, just in general, and then also on the podcast, but kind of primarily at LTM events, and specifically, I think, more when the Reverend is around, about discernment and calling. And then that also, then they get really giddy when the Reverend and Suzanne are side by side like they are now, and they're like, and how does my Enneagram number play a role in that? With y'all's journey of going into, you know, these roles in the Catholic Church and then leaving those roles, I don't know how many of our listeners on the podcast have heard you talk about your story of that, Dad, of being called in and, you know, being called to leave. But can y'all talk to that some? And then the fact that you both landed in such a, Dad says that he was going to be a butcher, I think, after, like, that was, all right, I don't know if that was a dream you had of being a butcher, but, or just you thought you'd be good at it, but he thought he was going to be a butcher. You know, now he's been, 30 years in the, not 30 years,
35
years in the Methodist Church, and you are clearly where, or I'm saying clearly, like I know what the hell I'm talking about, but it seems like you're clearly where you are supposed to be. And there's just so many people kind of looking to figure out how to find the spot that y'all have found. And it's not like you just found that spot. Y'all went this crazy route to get to where y'all are right now.
I think one of the things that I'm really aware of is we both entered religious life at very different times in our life. I had wanted to be a priest from the time I was a young boy growing up in Houston, and who admired the priests in our parish pre-Vatican II, and wanting to be like them and wanting to celebrate Mass and believing that you could care for other people and you could be a preacher of the gospel and make, you know, a difference in people's lives. So, Allison, I don't know what you know about me, but I entered seminary in 1961 and was in seminary for 13 years. By the time I did high school seminary and 2 years novitiate and college seminary and theology school, you know. So the education that I had was incredible because as Vincentian fathers, we were predominantly a teaching order here in the western part of the United States. So our education was just remarkable and incredible. And the intense spiritual training and education that we went through in those years. What I got to see was the Catholic Church prior to Vatican II, and then the Catholic Church as it was emerging after Vatican II, with great hope and great expectation. I love John the 23rd. And, you know, I'm old enough to have lived when Pius the 12th was still Pope, and he was very staid and very strict looking and acting. And so John the 23rd was like a bright light for the Catholic Church and continued with Paul the 6th and Vatican II and all of the changes that were coming. And so once I was ordained and I served in many different roles, from being a seminary professor and a vocation director and a hospital chaplain and a parish priest. I was a great advocate for the changes of Vatican II and really believed that that was what was going to make a huge difference in the Catholic Church and really move the Catholic Church forward, opening the doors and the windows and getting Father off the pedestal. And, you know, the years I was in seminary, we all wore cassocks all the time. We begged to get out of the cassocks and we begged to be able to wear clerical shirts and just, you know, look somewhat normal. We used to say that they dressed us like women, treated us like children, and expected us to come out men, you know. So I really look forward to that. And then, Joel, as you know, once after being ordained and all the things that I was doing and had an extraordinary spiritual experience of God's working in my life in Amarillo, I came back here to Dallas and we were able to start Life in the Trinity Ministries. And working side by side with Suzanne in the Catholic Church, teaching together in churches all over the country, we were advancing again the causes of Vatican II, and I'd become very disillusioned then with the role of women in the Catholic Church and the role of laity in the Catholic Church and the role of the hierarchy. If you have an extraordinary spiritual experience within the Catholic Church, bishops like to put their imprimatur on it and say, well, this is a real experience or not. And I wasn't willing to let them do that with my experience. So my choosing to leave the priesthood came out of that disillusionment after 26 years of all of those things that I had experienced. And when I left the priesthood, I had no idea that I would ever get to do ministry again. So after I left the priesthood and started dating Suzanne, which was pretty quick and
pretty awkward,
I still saw myself as a Catholic priest. So I said mass at home, said mass for the family, you know, continued to function in that role and not ever believing that I was going to ever get called to do anything different. And so you mentioned the butcher. When I left the priesthood, and that was the only thing I'd known from the time I was 14 years old, I thought, I don't know what else I'll ever do. I guess I can cut up a chicken.
And he can't. As it turns out, he can't.
So I thought I could be a a butcher. But and then as I tell everybody, I think God has a sense of humor in leading me back into ministry in the United Methodist Church. Because in the United Methodist Church, the bishops have no authority to set rules and regulations and that kind of thing. Women have a marvelous opportunity to be ministers and bishops.
Not quite equality yet.
Not quite equality yet, but we're working on it. But even women bishops in our denomination and the laity have all the power in the United Methodist Church. So it's...
You also say, though, that you were called into the priesthood and you believe you were called out of the priesthood. Allison, where is your story in relation to his?
Yeah, so Joe, I feel like I was baptized in the United Methodist Church.
Okay, there we go. You just went the other way. It all averages out in the end.
And then it became cool to be Southern Baptist, you know, like in high school, because we wanted to pray before school, during lunch, after school. There were all these groups, you know, in the South and Georgia and the Bible Belt for all this prayer. And it was very evangelical Baptist. And then I converted to Catholicism here in New Orleans. And it was really meeting, it was many things, but it was meeting Catholics who were living out the gospel values. After Hurricane Katrina, our archbishop in New Orleans had set our parish to close. And it was a, you know, historic church, the first Black Catholic church in the country. And it was very racist, which churches were going to be closed after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans and which ones weren't. So me and six former Black Panthers, I was one of the main organizers.
We got to have a pause. You can't just off the cuff say, me and six Black Panthers decided that we would. For anybody our age, that's a big sentence, woman.
Well, the only other story I know that parallels that is Jenny from Forrest Gump. So, it's pretty unique.
Yes. So we decided to occupy the rectory. We changed the locks on the doors. We boarded up the doors and windows. We occupied the rectory for a month until we got the archbishop to change his mind and keep our parish open after Katrina. And it was seeing the parishioners stand up. And at the time, I didn't realize how radical it was to challenge an archbishop's decision to close your parish.
It was dangerous in New Orleans.
Yeah. And so we had 24/7 vigil going on inside the sanctuary. You know, we were holding our own services. We had musicians, Grammy award-winning musicians coming through all hours of day and night. It was almost like a 24/7 block party. Everyone was bringing food out under these tents we had outside the rectory. People were sending food up to us in a bucket on a pulley to the third floor of the rectory for us to eat. And it was while I was there, I was reading our priest the books, you know, that he had, Father Jerome Ledoux. He was a Society of the Divine Word missionary priest. And he was also one of the first, I think he was the first Black man to get his doctorate of canon law in Rome, was a strict vegan, was the first of many things. So I was very inspired by him to convert to Catholicism. And then I was meeting a lot of Catholic nuns and priests at the School of the Americas Watch Movement in Fort Benning, Georgia, mm-hmm. who were putting their lives on the line and getting 6 months in federal prison and challenging U.S. imperialism and militarization and what the U.S. was doing in Central and South America, and meeting Father Roy Bourgeois and others. And so that's when I got introduced to vow religious life and meeting these sisters. And then kind of like when you're discerning child religious life, you kind of date different orders. So you meet the vocation director of all the different orders, and they kind of wine and dine you and take you out. I didn't have a spreadsheet for them.
I had a simple choice between the Vincentians or the Mary Nolers. I was one or the other.
The options, yeah. So we had, you know, I think there's more than 50 orders in New Orleans. So it was a lot to figure out. But yeah, so really felt, I knew I wanted to do social justice work the rest of my life. I wanted to do it in community with others and doing it. I never really felt called to have biological children or to be a full-time, long-term biological parent. And so a vow of celibacy wasn't that big of a deal for me at the time. And so started discerning vow of religious life and just felt this calling and would wake up and be like, this is ridiculous. What am I doing? And then it just kept, it was staying, and it stayed for, you know, 12, 13, 14 years. And then it was a few years, like the last few years, it was like, okay, who am I going to do life with for the long haul? You know, radical authenticity for myself was important to me. Having community and close proximity to me was important. Having long-term intimate relationships to support my spiritual journey and for my relationship with God to be supported by the people that I do life with on a daily basis was something that I cared about. And I realized that I needed a way of being in the world that would give me the availability to have my relational, emotional, physical intimacy needs met, and that vowed life in the context that I was in the United States with the age demographics of Catholic nuns in the US, it wasn't going to allow me to have those needs met. And so I needed to find others to plant roots together and to create this foundation for life with, and to build a social structure that would work to meet some of those needs, that would also allow me to continue to live out the values that I cared about around social justice, authenticity, radical availability, service, hope, courage, truth-telling, ongoing personal growth, deep listening to others, liberation, joy, integrity, a life of simplicity. So I wanted to continue to live those and try to figure out the container to do it. So I made my annual 10-day silent retreat with my spiritual director. This was during the pandemic. And just prayed a lot. And there's this poem on called She Let Go. And that poem was really helpful in helping me let go. It was the biggest decision I ever made, I think, was to leave vowed religious life. It was really hard. It's also very liberating. It was more liberating than I thought it was going to be. I thought everyone was going to be angry at me. I definitely felt like I had failed. And, you know, did I listen to the call right? Did I not do it right? Was this really not a call? You know, all the doubts and questions, and were Catholics going to be angry at me? Were the sisters going to be angry at me? But, you know, I just really felt God saying, you know, go, Allison, and I'll go with you, and our relationship will not change. And it hasn't. And, you know, my prayer life has stayed the same. It's like everything changed and nothing changed. And I think we have to learn to let go of the containers that no longer support us and the things that are important to us. And I have stayed Catholic, and that was intentional too. I have discerned ordination, both in the Catholic women's ordination movement and in other Protestant traditions. But, you know, the rituals within Catholicism, my own parish community is really important to me. The volumes of encyclicals of social justice teachings are important to me. And trying to make change from within and being a more progressive-minded Catholic, elevating and talking about what our values are and what our social justice teachings are, gives a way to do that and to reach a lot of people.
That's fantastic. I really admire you for that. I didn't have the luxury of everybody not being mad at me. Come from an only son, three sisters in an Italian family. So my parents were not happy. The order was not happy when I chose to leave. And I got terrible letters from parishioners who were certainly not happy with my choice. Yeah. But it was for me a very clear sense that God had led me into the priesthood, that God was calling me away from the priesthood to the married life, and that God was going to lead me back into ministry once again. So it's been a blessing to have my feet in two different denominations and be able to hold both of those at the same time. Richard Rohr says the very best protection against the next word of God is the last word of God. So if you're holding on to the last word, you might miss the next one. It's been a blessing and a gift. Of course, at this point in time, we have to retire in the Methodist Church at 72, and I'm 76. So, but still working. I'm part-time at First United Methodist Church in downtown Dallas, and besides doing what we do in Life in the Trinity Ministries. So,
yeah.
It was interesting to me to watch how much your living space your life around you reflects the things that are important to you. And I love Catholic churches, and we've gone to them everywhere we've ever been, especially back before they started locking churches. But our home also reflects that, and we were moving in the Methodist Church. You're appointed, and the bishop had moved us, and so we were moving. We were selling our house, and a couple came to look at it, and they wanted to bring their parents. And we have statues, and it's kind of like a Catholic arts and gifts store from the Southwest, right? Like
icons and
icons, lots of Indian art, and this woman who was the mother of the young couple who were looking, she was bowing everywhere in our house and crossing herself and doing the whole routine.
I love it.
And I said, our realtor said, "What's happening?" And I said, "They're Catholic." And she said, "Is it going to help us sell?" And I said, "Yes." It could keep us from selling to somebody else, but it's going to work for these folks.
Yeah. I think one thing that didn't, when the folks from Queer Eye came here, I shared about, how I use the house, and it got edited out. But, I have my bedroom and office is upstairs, and downstairs are guest rooms for folks who are coming home from immigrant detention center. So this is the first room, the first bed they sleep in that isn't in a prison in the United States, or for other people who need support, trans folks who can't get into the gender segregated homeless shelters, or kids who are kicked out of Covenant House, or whatever it may be. But creating a space, I'm like, what do I want people to feel when they come into this house? What do I want each room to feel like? To name the feeling of balance, of comfort, of wholesomeness, of healing when someone comes into a space, and really creating a space that feels like that for myself and for anyone who enters into a space. I think I'm very, very much affected by the environment around me. And a piece of it is being, the need to be in control of things. And I grew up, we had a lot of violence in my family growing up. My dad was very abusive and was in and out of incarceration because of it. And until he died of suicide, and when he came home. And so we didn't have, the house I grew up in was very chaotic and unpredictable. And so having some level of control and having things organized helps give me mental clarity and space to do work in a healthier way. And so keeping everything kind of organized and labeled in that way is helpful. I think creating the environment and the space where we can be our, the healthiest versions of ourselves. And I don't want to go into three productivity and efficiency around it, but that's the thing for me.
Well, I said
where things are, we buy things.
That's right. That's right. I said to Joe, I said, I wonder if things are labeled because she wants everything to be efficient. And so with labels, she knows where everything is. She knows just where to get it. It's a very efficient way to do things. And then I said, or are things labeled because she opens her home to other people and she wants them to know where everything is? and this will get cut out if you want it to. But then I said to Joe, I don't think that's it, though, because she had panties on her panty drawer label, and I don't think she really wants anybody who's there to know where those are. So I was very confused about the labels.
Well, there was nothing was safe, because one that I thought was humorous in my mind, you had your journal labeled. And I was like, who needs a journal labeled? Like, you know that's your journal, right? So I just think, I thought there was like a giveaway at the label maker. She's like, I'm going to use all of this.
Like, are you still labeling?
Yeah, I do. And a lot of it is, especially in the communal spaces, sure. It is like, because a lot of people do come through. I have a lot of people who come through the house every day. Tonight we have, I have 3 hours of meetings this evening, people talking about classism and what are our class backgrounds, and doing our own healing work around what we were taught about around class growing up. So lots of different things happen in this house. So a lot of it is for that in communal spaces, but then also in my own personal spaces. I use the same kind of composition books for lots of different things. So I have my dream journal. I have the journal I write with in the morning. I have my prayer book where when people ask me to pray for them, I'll put their prayer requests in there so I can go to it during prayer time.
So efficient. It's so very efficient.
But it is a little too much. I get it. And yeah, I don't want anyone else wearing my underwear.
There you go.
My full laundry. I don't have to do the extra thinking of like,
where do I keep these? Right.
Thus on the door, it says Allison's room.
That's right. No, that's right.
Yeah, that means do not enter.
Well, this is very Suzanne of me, but we will be in New Orleans in the next couple of years, and I will want to see you.
Absolutely. Please come. Yeah, I would love to have y'all over. I love to cook for people. I love to host people.
Well, I think one of the things that I would ask way ahead of time, because it's a big ask, and that is I think I would want to know if Joe and I could just follow you for a day. Go where you go and listen to you do what you do and meet the people that you do that with.
Man, you're not going to be able to keep up with her for one hour.
I was just going
to
say.
Yeah, this is a cute idea. It's not happening.
Have you been paying attention to the energy? Yeah. Neither one of us could.
And 2 years from now, not a chance.
Walk and keep up with her.
So she might be able to hook y'all up in like a red wagon behind her and see how that goes.
You and I'll talk about this offline, Allison.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll be able to keep up. And yeah, every day is unpredictable. I don't know who's going to call, who's going to come over, what's going to happen with the emergency. It's like a firefighter, every day kind of putting out fires. There's the regular things that are ongoing, but yeah, every day is totally different.
It's so energizing for me, even though I'm 73 and slow, because it's all the things that I believe in. And I think one of the reasons we do what we do, it's interesting because it's been about 6 or 7 months. We were sitting right here. We had just finished a podcast. And Joel turned to me and he said, Mom, you know what we do here at the Micah Center? We create community. That's what we do. And that is what we do. And our communities are very different from yours. And yet, our communities, like yours, are safe places for people to reveal who they truly are. And that must look a thousand different ways. And a lot of people want to have a community and they have no idea how to start one, how to be part of one. And all I can ever say to people is your focus can't be on starting a community. It has to be focused outside of you on something you're doing, and you will find community there. And it sounds like you do that, a hundred times a week.
Yeah, there is so much community. And when I do spiritual direction, it's one of the things that come up the most is people just feeling the loneliness and isolation and the hunger for community, the hunger for meaning and connection and relationship. Whether people are single or married or live in an intentional community or live by themselves, that hunger for connection and for community. And I think a lot of it is our technology and social media and our disconnect from each other. And just tell people, get out of your house, whatever it is, get out of your house. You know, you look at cultures that have community, people aren't sitting in their own homes all day long. You know, you visit any other country and spaces is so communal. It's not this individualistic thing we have in the United States. And so turn off the TV, get out of your house, go find people and connect, whether it's in a pottery class, at a protest, the public library, such a great gathering space, just doing work with other people. If you work from home, just take your computer, go work somewhere else where there's 30 other people also doing work and connecting. And it's a choice we make. And we also create the communities that we need for ourselves. And people are probably hungry for the same type of thing.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that communities require leadership.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I was just very aware as Allison was talking of places where our interests have overlapped. My interests, your interests have overlapped. I thought of teaching in the seminary. We had seminarians from the Josephite community who were, the order was started specifically to serve people of color. And our seminary was in Lumberton, Texas, Allison, which was a bedrock area of the Ku Klux Klan. And so I spent a lot of time fighting the oppression of the Klan, and as they drove through our seminary every week, checking on us, making sure our students were not out and about. And for a period of time, I was pastor of Dallas's oldest deeded and dedicated Christian church here in the Dallas area. And we have a local Baptist pastor who used to say terrible things about our Jewish brothers and sisters and terrible things about our Muslim brothers and sisters. And when I was pastor of that church, I felt the need to call the rabbi at the biggest temple and apologize, or, you know,
on
behalf of Christians or call the imam and apologize to him for what has been said and how things were done, and the opportunities that I've had when, during our previous president's time in office, when so many migrants were being imprisoned, to be among those, some of the first to get into one of the prisons to visit the migrant teenagers. And justice is so very, very important. And it's, as I get older, it is beginning to become more and more important, the Hebrew concept of justice, that everybody have enough. And we live in a culture and in a world where that is certainly not the truth. And we have to fight for it, because it is the way of the kingdom.
I just have to say about both of you that I do think there is something in your formation to be a sister or to be a Catholic priest that builds within you a desire for justice. And I don't know, I didn't get that anywhere. I ended up teaching theology in a Catholic high school, and I team taught with a nun and a priest, and we did, the name of it was Social Issues and Social Justice, and I was learning every day along with the kids. Sociology was my piece, not religion. And I just don't know that we give our children opportunities to do things that require risk. Instead, I think we offer safe opportunities and expect them to be transformational, and they're not. They're lovely, but they're not transformational.
Yeah. And I think to really connect with, like, you know, what sets their heart on fire. And if they can also understand that they're partly oppressed, I mean, even if it's, you know, young white rich girls, you know, it's yeah. like, as a woman, people are trying to control your body. Yeah. Even, yeah. you know, young white boys growing up being told they can't feel their feelings and they can't express their emotions, and that's not socially acceptable. And so you're not allowed to do the healing work or grieving work, to live out the fullness of your own humanity. And for people to see how the many ways that oppression comes at us in so many ways, and to notice that and to name that and to allow that to set our hearts on fire for whatever issue propels our heart. And for me, it was seeing racism growing up in Georgia. Like, my schools were about half Black, half white, and my middle school, high school would be shut down for weeks at a time for racial riots. And I'm only 42. That was in the 80s, you know, yeah. 90s. It wasn't yeah. like the 60s, you know. And this was still happening. It was also seeing my mother being abused growing up. It was also being queer and also being religious and having, you know, religious teaching saying that I was abnormal or evil or not right or backwards, and not being accepted as a queer Christian. I think we find, figuring out what it is that sets our hearts on fire, and then finding community out of necessity to do something to change the conditions of those oppressions.
Yeah.
And I think when we visit countries and places where there is a deep sense of community, it's out of necessity because people realize their interdependence and that they need each other.
Right.
I think that's something we have a lot of really beautiful community in New Orleans. And I think it's because of the mutual aid culture that's been here for hundreds of years out of necessity, because we live on the Gulf and hurricanes hit. We have no choice. It's a great equalizer when Katrina hits and everyone loses everything. Pretty much, you know, everyone is in line for the same food and, right. and the same right. supplies from the Red Cross. And so it's community out of necessity. And for folks of privilege, it's a little harder to figure out that, but it's also there. And yeah, what does set our hearts on fire and propel us to, you know, keep going, and do something and change something and not get too comfortable, and to keep being willing to be uncomfortable and comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable.
Yes.
Yeah. A good question for folks would be, how often does whatever you're doing on your phone set your heart on fire?
Yeah. My phone is just ringing now with folks from death row.
Well, there's that.
they'll call back.
Wow.
Well, that's actually the perfect, because we're coming up against it time-wise, and that's what I wanted to end with, was you talking a little bit about what you do there. You talked to it some a little bit earlier on, an hour and a half ago, and so people, or if this is split into two, the previous episode, will you talk some about that and what you do? And then also with the two biggest questions we get nowadays, is people who are like, where can I find a therapist who, you know, knows the Enneagram or a therapist? And where can I find how do I find a spiritual director? If you'll talk to kind of that question of the spiritual director part, I don't know if you're like, man, I've got a ton of therapists that I know, but how does somebody find a spiritual director who, and if you'll talk about what your role and what you do there. And then also if you'll plug your, and we'll put the link in there, plug the link for your work.
Well, thanks. Yeah. So folks can follow my work on, I'm on Instagram, Allison_New Orleans. Also on Facebook, TikTok, LinkedIn, all the things. But you can find me there. For folks looking for a spiritual director, Spiritual Directors International is kind of our membership association for spiritual directors. You can go to find a spiritual director and put in your tradition or spirituality preferences and find someone. A lot of spiritual directors will, you know, meet with folks remotely, by Zoom or by phone. That's becoming more of a norm. So it doesn't have to be someone in your area if you're open to that. And sometimes you'll find that you might find someone that you connect with that meets your needs that may not be in your geographic area there. And yeah, I've served as a spiritual advisor on death row in Louisiana, and I've been visiting the guys there for 19 years. A spiritual advisor is the only person who's in the room with someone when they are being executed by the government. And we prepare them as well as we can spiritually, emotionally, and psychologically for death by the government. We meet with their family, their children, their grandchildren. We plan their funerals and accompany them in every way. And so I've been doing that, and we have a governor who's wanting to bring back executions. And this is one of the guys who's next to be executed when they resume this year is Chris, who's one of my directees on death row, and he's 80 years old and in a wheelchair, and is a enrolled citizen of the Choctaw Apache Nation here. And so really praying for him. And it's a really beautiful ministry to get to accompany the guys. This here's a picture of the 12-step group inside of on death row. And so just seeing them do their own spiritual work and healing work and doing 12-step program, even though they have no access to alcohol or any kind of substance because they've been on death row for decades. And so, yeah, so I do that ministry. And then I've recently trained about 25 spiritual directors to prepare them for the role of a spiritual advisor on death row to accompany people since we'll have executions resuming. And then I started a group called LIFE, Louisiana Interfaith Against Executions. And we're about 300 faith leaders and clergy of different traditions, of all traditions, that oppose the death penalty and work to stop executions and have prayer vigils and meet with the governor and legislators and work to create policy change and pray for an end to this moral stain on our society. When we have something like the death penalty on the books as law, that sets the moral standard for how we see human dignity and how we see people's ability to change and be rehabilitated and to change. So we work to end that.
Not to bring up the earlier you brought down the mood a little bit with something you said. Uh-huh. I'm not trying to do the opposite side of that.
However,
it's been like 25 years since I saw it. Does Dead Man Walking hold up? And is that in my head? Are you like Susan Sarandon? Is that
far from it? But I work a lot with Sister Helen Prejean. We just spoke last Friday at a symposium together, and you know, a lot of her work is around Dead Man Walking, and which is now the book, the movie, the opera. Now going to be a children's book. And it's amazing that a story, you know, that she started telling publicly, you know, decades ago, still, you know, has meaning to get people to think about it. And I think the power of that is just sharing a human experience and a human journey. It's not an activism thing of saying the death penalty is wrong, but it's taking someone on that journey and on that story. And I think we all have stories to tell, and to try to tell a story in a way that brings someone on that journey with us to feel what we're feeling and to hold the nuance and hold the mystery and the conflicting emotions around it. And Sister Helen does that really well.
Yeah. I saw a quote from the Dalai Lama this week that said, "Don't worry about your work today. It will have meaning in 17 years." It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, and we have to take the time to harvest the meaning of it. And yeah. I think at three, who's always on the go and always doing, it's like, you know, for every hour of like action or activity I do, whether it's, you know, supporting a protest movement or sitting on death row, I need to take at least 2 hours for each hour of activity to reflect and like harvest the meaning, journal with it, sit with it, feel into it. Notice, learn from it. I'm not very good at it, but I know that's what I need to do.
Well, once somebody says, hold the mystery, and then circles back to anagram work, that's when you know we've made the full circle.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. Convo. Yeah. What a delight it has been to know that you are in the world. What a privilege it's been to spend a couple of hours with you.
What a privilege to spend this time with y'all, and so grateful to have this intimate space together and to share and to learn. And there's so much more I would love to delve into. And I told a friend yesterday, I said, oh gosh, I'm on this podcast on the Enneagram. They're gotta go real deep.
That's right.
You crushed it.
Talk about all the things, you know, the deceit, the pretending, the mask.
Well, you did a great job. And we, anytime Joe is with us, we let him wrap up and bless us. So let's do that.
I just want to say, Allison, it's been a blessing and it's been a gift to be with you as someone who has spent his life encouraging other people to be kingdom people and to actually live the kingdom. It's been a pure gift and blessing to share with someone who is truly a kingdom person. It's obvious in what you say. It's obvious in what you do. And there is no doubt that God has rested God's hand upon you and blessed you in countless ways so that you could truly be a blessing to other people. Thank you for blessing us, and may your work flourish for a long time, at least the next 17 years when we'll begin to understand it.
Amen. Yes. Thank you so much.
Blessings.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.